And again, somebody out in this crowd last year said, could you please somebody speak about evil? And bless his heart, Larry volunteered. Thank you, Larry.
You're welcome. The great Zen master was dying, and all of the monks in the monastery and the novices line up to have a last word with their master. A long line of monks that go outside the room down the side of the building are present for the dying. And the eldest monk leans down to the great master and says, Master, a final word about the meaning of life. And the master says, life is like a cup of tea. And so they pass the word down all through the line. It takes a long time. The master says, life is like a cup of tea. The master says, life is like a cup of tea. And it makes it all the way to the end, where there is a not very bright young novice who says, life is like a cup of tea. What does that mean? And so they pass it back. Master, what does life is like a cup of tea mean? And it goes all the way back through the line and comes to the head, and he bends down and whispers, Master, what does life is like a cup of tea mean? At which time the master says, maybe life isn't like a cup of tea. When I arrived here, I thought I had it down. Evil is like a cup of tea. With now the accumulation of wisdom that we have heard from all of the presenters and the various workshops, I have to say, maybe it's not. So what I know about evil is less than what I knew when I prepared this talk. And so you'll just have to take what it is and go with it. My wife said, as I read this unrevised manuscript, I've revised it at least four times since being here, and she said, it's a little bit like you have constructed a structure. You've put together a building next to the wall called evil to enable us to look into evil. So if you believe that I'm now going to exhaust the subject of evil, you will be disappointed. But perhaps we can construct together a scaffolding that will allow us to peer a little more closely into the question of evil. One cannot continue the interior journey for very long without meeting the question of evil. Indeed, even if you're not on an inner journey, the question of evil, as it impacts our external lives, will be just as persistent. I would guess that for more than a few of us here, it has been dealing with evil in the external that has invited and sometimes dragged us into something of the inner journey. If to do nothing else, but to try to get evil in some manageable context. The place of evil in the world is a question not just for us, but for many of the spiritual and intellectual pursuits and disciplines. It certainly plays a key role in philosophy as it creates its paradigms of thought and interaction. It provokes a kind of empirical curiosity in psychology. What drives evil? From where do those impulses come? It clearly lies at the heart of the great religious mythologies as they set out to create a cosmology in which human and divine can meet. In fact, it's likely that any religion that does not adequately deal with the question of evil as it daily impacts us will have a short and superficial life. There are perhaps more, as many at least, definitions of evil as there are people in this room, because the definitions of evil tend to rise not from dictionaries but from our own experience. We can be a little bit like the Supreme Court justice who was confronted with the question of pornography, who said, "I may not be able to define it, but I know it when I see it." We may not be able to define evil in any exhaustive way, but we know it when we experience it. In fact, that gives us the first dilemma to be faced when dealing with the question of evil. To what degree is evil simply a relative matter that depends on the person or the society that is doing the defining? For example, the Hebrew slaves were finally delivered from Egypt when the final and most devastating plague killed the firstborn sons of the Egyptians. Obviously, it would depend on whether one is a Hebrew slave or an Egyptian parent to define evil in that story. As the story of deliverance goes forward, those former slaves were given the land of Canaan to be their own. A profound blessing, except for the tribes who were already living there and always thought the land was their own, the reprise of which story is still being played out in the Middle East. Such questions of evil's relativity are part of the fabric of history. If you explore the writings of the early Puritan settlers of this nation, you may run across a little essay entitled, "The Wonderful Preparation the Lord Christ by His Providence Wrought for His People's Abode in the Western World." The wonderful preparation wrought by the Lord Christ was a smallpox epidemic that nearly eliminated the native population who happened to already possess the land now desired by the Puritans. An interesting twist to activities of the Lord Christ. Much of the present debate about the war in Iraq has to do with sorting through good and evil. The people have been delivered from the despotic rule of Saddam Hussein. And in the process, much of the country lies in ruin, and thousands continue to die even today. What is good? What is evil? Where do they meet? How do we ever decide? From the human point of view, evil seems relative to the viewpoint of the observer. It was, after all, Shakespeare's Hamlet who said, "There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." The question we're facing, for the next few minutes at least, is whether or not there is any objective way to measure good and evil. Is there any way to view good and evil other than through the ego? It is, after all, the job of the ego to determine how an event or a situation affects me or affects the things that I value. Thus, good and evil tend to be relative to whatever has influenced the ego by a particular upbringing, a particular value system, a particular religious outlook or whatever. But is there absolute good and absolute evil that exists outside our egoistic evaluation? I'm aware in myself a certain resistance to believing, or wanting to believe, I should say, that there is objective evil operating within my spiritual and psychological framework. Now, this is more than a disbelief in a personified devil who's running around making good people do bad things. It's more a tendency in myself to want to see evil in terms of the material rather than the spiritual and psychological. For example, as one whose moral judgments were significantly influenced by the social unrest of the 1960s, I find myself wanting to believe that the world's ills or evil operating in the world comes primarily through political and economic means. That is to say, a different political system, and when I'm being honest, it probably should be one designed by me. A different political system would take away much of the evil, or maybe it would be economic reform, or maybe better and more equitable education, or maybe another social program of assistance. All of that to me seems more comfortable and more manageable than to believe that evil actually resides within my spiritual and psychological reality and the spiritual and psychological realities of the collective life of the planet. The flaw is that one need only look at human history to know that changing political structures and manipulating economic policies has never managed to remove evil from the world. We might even make the case that evil, if it is measured by human misery, is often increased as we manipulate our political and economic forms. How many times have we gone to war in order to eliminate some evil, only to live for generations afterwards recovering from the evil wrought by our campaign? Someone said recently, you can no more win a war than you can win an earthquake. Nonetheless, there are countless good people who daily strive to resist evil as it is found in the material world. Indeed, in the baptismal covenant in the Episcopal Church, we promise to resist evil. Lives spent battling material evil, in my opinion, are lives very well spent. To determine that evil will not in any ultimate way be addressed through our challenges to what Paul called the principalities and powers of this world is not to say that challenges to principalities and powers of this world should end, but only says that there is more to evil than meets the eye. There remains the question of non-material evil, evil that does reside within the spiritual and psychological realm, and very likely forms the base from which material evil grows. Said differently, spiritual, psychological darkness, unaddressed, will always find its way to material expression. I'm reminded of the story of the Riverside Village, whose residents spent much of the day pulling babies out of the river as they drifted helplessly along. Finally, they realized that while some of them should remain by the riverbank saving these helpless babies as they drifted by, others ought to go upstream and find out who was throwing the babies in the first place. So now let us move upstream. Is there non-material evil functioning at levels beneath what finally appears in our material activities? Old Testament people would probably find our inquiry into the presence of evil in the world curious at best. The scriptures that make up the Old Testament reveal a radically monotheistic understanding of God in that all things originate with God. Not just all good things, but all things. If good things came, they came from God. If bad things came, they came from God. So Isaiah can say in chapter 45, I am the Lord and there is no other. I form light, I create darkness, I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. And later in chapter 54, I create the blacksmith who builds a fire and forges the weapons. I also create the soldier who uses the weapons to kill. And in 1 Samuel 18, we read about Saul's great depression and anger over David's rise to popularity. Until in verse 10, we finally read, an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house. And as the story goes on, almost impales David on his spear. It is telling that there is no developed notion of Satan as the great tempter and thwarter of good in the Old Testament. Even in the book of Job, Satan is not the carrier of evil, but simply a member of the household of God, engaging God in a conversation. That is to say that the kind of comfortable dualism with which we're familiar, God being good and Satan being evil, hadn't made its mark in most of the Old Testament era. God was the indiscriminate source of all that existed. We might say that the conceptualized God was not split, but whole, even to the point of encompassing opposite energy. Now, Jung's description of the processes of individuation teach us to be suspicious of splits within our own personalities, where only the light is owned, while the darkness remains unclaimed and hidden, and therefore very powerful in disrupting our lives through the presence of countless complexes hidden in the shadow. So perhaps the Old Testament image of God, who encompasses both light and darkness being contained in one divine wholeness, is not an unfamiliar or an uncomfortable notion to those of us here for whom personal wholeness has likewise brought light and dark together. However, the radical monotheism of the Old Testament, while intriguing, doesn't move us much closer to answer the question we set out to answer. In fact, it may complicate it. The question is whether or not there is objective evil at work in the spiritual and psychological world in which we live. And now we must add the further question, which Doug alluded to the other day, is God simply amoral? Would God just as easily produce evil as good? when you are God, does the end always justify the means? Well, by the time of the New Testament, there has occurred a movement away from the radical monotheism of the Old Testament that has God carrying good and evil fairly indiscriminately. The New Testament writings are clear that a remarkable shift has occurred in the thinking, or perhaps the experience, of the people of God. The Old Testament God, who brings darkness as readily as God brings light, is now described in John's prologue as the light. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness cannot overcome it. And this light of the world sets about to create a community of disciples who will be known by their love. By this everyone will know, says Jesus, that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. God in the New Testament is clearly the source of all that is right and all that is good. And it is God's intense desire that humanity come into relationship with goodness. Indeed, coming into such a relationship with what is good, humanity will find meaning and purpose. In a word, humanity would be saved, would be healed by the divisions within their own being that separates them from the divine purpose. By this time, the notion of there being an evil one whose purpose it was to undo the goodness of God was well developed. God is no longer the source of evil, but Satan, the tempter, the devil. It is the devil who leads Jesus into the wilderness to challenge his self-understanding. It is the devil who remains close at hand, looking for other opportunities to thwart the divine plan of salvation. It is the devil who enters into Judas and brings about betrayal. It is the demonic that brings about sickness. It is the devil who rejoices in the sinfulness of humanity and uses every opportunity to strengthen sin, so that no less a great saint as Paul finally cries out, "I do not understand my own actions. For I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inmost self, but I see in my members another law at war with the law of my mind, and making me captive to the law of sin which dwells in my members." Once the image of God, or the concept of God, is freed from carrying the darkness of evil, and that function is now being carried by Satan, there are many possible directions for our thinking. So let us look at two. One, once the image of God is split so that darkness resides outside the divine, it allows those who believe they were created in the image of God to do the same thing. That is, my dark deeds come from Satan's overwhelming powers of temptation. Evil, says Paul, lies close at hand. The devil made me do it. And much of my religious activity then has to do with arming myself through spiritual practices and devotion to God against that powerful force. Now, I think there is wisdom in traveling this path if Satan is not trivialized to simply become some caricature with horns and pitchfork, or if Satan is not allowed to exist wholly as a separate entity. In this view, Satan is the objective power of evil operating in the world, and time-honored spiritual disciplines provide the soul with balance between light and darkness. The practices of the great mystics were often practices that struggled with the power of those opposites operating in their own lives. And it is no coincidence that many of those disciplines call for a surrendering of the self or the ego to the larger will of God, or Jung's self, capital S. Which brings us to a second way of viewing the God and Satan duality. Jung believed that the deepest urge or instinct in every living being was the need to fulfill itself, and that fulfillment was imprinted on the self, the center of our being. Jung's self and Christianity's Christ within have much in common, and I find myself at least using those terms quite interchangeably. There is within each of us a call towards wholeness that will answer the question, for what was I born? Within the self, there is that totality of conscious and unconscious material that contains our divine imprint, and much of the inner journey is a journey bringing the two together. That is, bringing as much as possible to consciousness and thereby coming to deeper and deeper self-awareness, or in Jung's term, individuation, becoming the unique, differentiated individual that creation had in mind from the beginning. Jung also speaks of the ego-self axis, that connection that exists between the ego, that which is able to articulate identity, the ego, and the self, that which includes much that the ego doesn't know, but is our true identity. It's helpful for me to imagine this axis as the information highway in our inner being, where dreams and insights and yearnings of the self are trying to inform the ego. Those ego-self conversations play a big role in dream work, play the total role, I think, in the inner journey. I want to share with you two of what I think are ego-self conversations as a way to help identify, perhaps for you, your own conversations. One of them you are familiar with. It comes from the fourth chapter of Luke's Gospel. Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, returned from the Jordan and was led by the Spirit in the wilderness, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil. He ate nothing at all during those days, and when they were over, he was famished. The devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command this stone to become a loaf of bread." Jesus answered him, "It is written, one does not live by bread alone." Then the devil led him up and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of the world. And the devil said, "To you I will give their glory and all this authority, for it has been given over to me, and I will give it to anyone I please. If you then will worship me, it will all be yours." Jesus answered him, "It is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him." Then the devil took him to Jerusalem and placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you to protect you. and on their hands they will bear you up, and you will not dash your foot against a stone. Jesus answered him, It is said, Do not put the Lord your God to the test. When the devil had finished every test, he departed until an opportune time. It is telling that that conversation of Jesus occurs right after his baptism, when he is driven, Scripture says, into the desert to do what? To explore his understanding of self, to allow his ego to come to grips with what he has just heard. And what has he heard? This is my beloved. Listen to him. Jesus is driven by that identity that has come to him into the desert to test it, to test his identity. And after he has explored that and come to an identity, that is, that the ego has come to a place where it realizes that he is the beloved of God, called to a mission to save the world, it's very telling that there is then this conversation to test the solidity of the ego's position. And the darkness comes, the devil comes, the evil one comes within Jesus' own being and begins to say, Surely you don't believe that. You are the beloved of God. If you are the beloved of God, why don't you turn these rocks into bread and feed people, and that might really accomplish something? If you are the beloved of God, work with a different system, and we can control all the kingdoms of the world. If you are the beloved of God, if that's really what you think, then throw yourself off the pinnacle of the temple. Everyone will be so impressed, and we'll all know that you are the beloved of God. The self of Jesus, his interior divine, has now given him an identity that has to be challenged. And this conversation goes on between ego and self, between the new identity that Jesus has just taken on, this fragile new ego of being the beloved of God, being challenged by forces that would have it redefined. And yet it is the self, the divine within Jesus himself, that is able to withstand the temptation. But it is not the 40 days in the wilderness that solidifies the ego of Jesus to understand himself as ready to be the beloved Redeemer. It is the test. It is the conversation. It is the ego-self conversation that finally brings him to that place where his identity is solid enough that he can shape a community that will indeed change the course of history. That's an interior conversation, an interior challenge to Jesus' own ego, I believe. And it is the self who provides the answers. Man does not live by bread alone. You shall not tempt the Lord your God. And Jesus survives the test, and the ego is strengthened for the journey. The other ego-self conversation that I will share with you comes from a dream of my own that I had not too far into my being the diocesan bishop of Arkansas. I dreamed one night that I went down into the basement of my home where there was rushing water coming from somewhere, and I was distressed at what I was going to have to repair. But while the water was rushing around, it washed away one of the walls in the basement, behind which was a corpse. And the corpse spoke to me to remind me that I had killed him and I had sealed him in the wall, and it was now to be exposed. And in the dream, I had a powerful memory of doing that. I immediately knew that I had killed this person and that I could even remember brick by brick sealing the body up into the wall. When I awoke, that image was so powerful that it took me some time to realize that it was a dream. In fact, that image was so powerful. Now, this will sound funny, but it wasn't funny at the time. It was so powerful that for several weeks, I, in my mind, made lists of people that I knew to see if any of them were missing. It is true. I went through all of my cousins and discovered they were all accounted for. Went through, thankfully, a shorter list of early lovers. They were all accounted for. I truly did that on driving to work for days and days. One side of my brain would say, you know, you're being foolish. But another part of me was saying, you'd better check. You'd better check, because that was very real. That was very real. Now, here's what I discovered, and it came at a very good time. I discovered in that sort of interior agony, I discovered my ability to kill a person who got in my way. Not theoretically, but truly. I became aware of an energy within me that could conceivably kill someone who got in my way, and I would seal them in the wall, and that would be it. Why was this important? I had just been elected Bishop of Arkansas. I, in the patriarchal system, was the patriarch. There is no bigger invitation to inflation of ego than to become a bishop in a system that names itself after the bishopric, the Episcopal Church. And it was very important for me to discover at that profound level that I had the power to kill people who got in my way and seal them up and forget about them, because I had ample opportunity to do that very thing in varying levels of reality as a bishop. I believe that it was the self who gave me the dream and required me, through the ego, required me to have that conversation for several weeks and to discover the strength of that energy that made me a safer person in a position of authority. Those are the kinds of conversations, I think, that the ego and the self will be constantly having. Those are the kinds of conversations that the dreams invite. The problem is that the ego is very often quite contented to stay where it is. After all, it took enough trouble to get to where we are. Why keep messing with the ego? Here is the problem. A contented ego is the perfect place for evil to flourish. Let me say it again. A contented ego is the perfect place for evil to flourish because all things, big and small, matter only with regard to its impact on me and what matters to me. Most, perhaps all of the evil I have instigated in my life or participated in my life came in service to my ego. The evil that has been done to me over the years was the result of others serving their own egocentricity. The God-Satan duality exists within your own being, where there is a constant conversation going on between self and ego, between what lies in the shadow and the light that alone transforms the dark shadow, between what you've settled for today and what God within knows you to be. It may be that none of us would grow towards wholeness or individuation if we didn't keep running into evil. Evil that so disrupts our lives and our thinking about life that we reach for resources deep within ourselves, and by the grace of God, we find them there in the self. John Sanford has written in his book, Evil, the Shadow Side of Reality, these words: I think it can be said that no true healing ever occurs unless a person does begin to see good and evil in his or her life from the broader viewpoint of the self instead of the limited viewpoint of the ego. It is not too much to say that the healing of the soul is fundamentally a revelation of good and evil, and therefore a shift from ego to self. Dr. Jung was once asked if there was any hope for the world. He is said to have replied, "It depends on how many people will do their inner work." We began this inquiry by wondering whether or not there could be identified an objective evil at work in the world that didn't depend on the ego's interpretation of what's good and what's bad. I've convinced myself, at least, that there is such evil at work in the lives of every individual and in the collective. It comes from the unexamined, unchallenged ego. Its antidote lies within the soul of every one of us, willing to measure life by the broad and the deep standards of the self, the Christ within. And so, in a sense, I end here with the same thing I said in my first talk. Perhaps the future of the world really does depend upon those willing to challenge the ego with the broad, deep understanding of the self, indeed, with those willing to do their inner work. The end.